This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, has the Prime Minister succeeded in hitting the reset button and smoothing tensions with China? And a homegrown renewable energy breakthrough. The CSIRO develops what it's calling a world-beating technology for hydrogen-powered cars.
For a car manufacturer's point of view, we see this as a massive step for Australia. Just in the last couple of days, within the Korean newspapers, the government's announced 16,000 cars will go on the road and over 300 hydrogen stations. They need to power those cars on gas from somewhere. Why couldn't it be renewable hydrogen from Australia?
But first, this lunchtime, we speak with the new chief executive of the Commonwealth Bank, Matt Comyn, who this morning delivered a 4% fall in the bank's full-year profit. It's the first profit fall since 2009 at the height of the global financial crisis, but the results still came in at $9.3 billion. In one of his first interviews as head of the Commonwealth Bank, Mr. Comyn has told The World Today that he's working hard to rebuild the bank's shattered reputation. But he won't guarantee there'll be no more scandal. Matt Comyn spoke with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Well, Matt Comyn, these are your first set of results in the CEO hot seat. How hard has it been to settle in?
Well, it has been a challenging year, Peter, as you said. We've been very focused on making sure that we're addressing some of the key issues and resolving those, getting a leadership team in place, and now we're very much focused on becoming a simpler and better bank.
This is the first fall in profit in 9 years. Do you feel you've copped a hospital pass, given the financial and reputational fallout from the scandals you've taken on?
Well, as I said, it is has been a challenging year, but we've been working hard to address a number of those issues and importantly make sure they don't reoccur, and now we're very much focused on ensuring we're a better bank for our customers in the future.
But even though you weren't chief executive at the time of the big scandals, you were a very senior executive in behind in the Rev. How much responsibility do you take for what went on?
Well, there's certainly things that I would have done differently. There's no escaping that. And I've been very focused on making sure that I've been addressing and trying to get to the root cause of the issues that have caused concern for both us and, of course, our customers. And we're very focused on making sure they don't repeat.
Much of the pain in these results comes from the $700 million penalty in relation to the anti-money laundering breaches. But given the revelations we've heard from the Royal Commission, how much more of a financial hit are you factoring in?
Of course, that's very difficult to predict. The AUSTRAC penalty brings to a close a set of serious failures on our behalf, but we now have resolved those. We're working very closely with AUSTRAC and making sure we're protecting the financial system going forward. We will, of course, continue to engage openly and transparently in the Royal Commission and await the findings that will come as a result of that.
You say that this has been a difficult period for the CBA, but I think it's probably fair to say that that's a bit of an understatement given the pressure you're under and what other scandals might come out of the Royal Commission.
Well, as I said, it has been, but also, I mean, I'm very grateful to have the tens of thousands of people around the country who are bearing the brunt of issues which they've had nothing to do with.
Given the big headline from the results announcement that you want to become a simpler, better bank, are you confident in saying now that all the scandals and all the bad news is out?
I couldn't be confident of that, but of course, I'm very focused on making sure that we're proactively reviewing all parts of our business and operations, making sure we're getting to the root cause of what's led to any of those problems. And if anything does come up, we will deal with that transparently and openly and make sure that no customers are impacted.
Just on a personal front, how shocked were you about some of the Royal Commission revelations? There was, of course, the AMP fees for no service, but also the CBA admitted charging dead people.
Well, in that particular case of an individual advisor that had done that, it was totally unacceptable. Of course, it's very confronting to listen to stories, particularly the cases where our individual customers, and to think that they have got an experience like that from us is very disappointing and completely unacceptable. We're going to make sure that those sorts of issues never repeat.
The Royal Commissioner, Kenneth Hayne, delivers his interim report in September and his final report in February next year. But you seem to be working very hard to preempt what's likely to be even tougher regulation.
We're certainly working hard on trying to address the issues that are obvious to us that need to be fixed. But of course, we know that the Royal Commission is very thorough and comprehensive review of the financial system. We'll have the opportunity to continue to engage, and we will look to respond to the recommendations as they come out.
But do you accept that given the revelations from the Royal Commission about AMP, for example, not your responsibility, but there have been references from Rowena Orr QC, the senior counsel assisting, about potential criminal behaviour, do you think that Kenneth Hayne might end up referring potential civil or criminal charges to the Commonwealth DPP?
I wouldn't like to speculate on what may flow from that, but of course making sure that we learn from the mistakes of the past.
Your predecessor, Ian Narev, lost $5.3 million in bonus payments in the wake of the money laundering scandal, and you personally forfeited $1.3 million. Do you expect to lose more bonuses if you don't succeed in rebuilding the CBA's reputation?
My performance will be determined on an annual basis by the board, and the remuneration will be adjusted based on the performance that I'm able to deliver.
That's the Commonwealth Bank Chief Executive, Matt Common, with the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan, who's with me now in the studio. So, Peter, the Commonwealth Bank wasn't the only financial giant announcing a downturn in its profit today. Tell us about how the wealth manager AMP is faring, especially given the Royal Commission revelations it faced.
Yes, well, this is a big one. AMP's first half net profit has plunged a massive 74%. From $445 million down to $115 million. It's a stunning headline that really amplifies the fallout from the Royal Commission. For example, fees for no service and other major issues for AMP. But even when you strip out the one-off costs associated with things like client remediation and legal costs, AMP's underlying profit, the one they prefer, is still down 7%. So far this year, AMP has lost around $4 billion in market value. Its shares are down more than 30%, but there could be more damage to come, given that, as I mentioned to Matt Common just then, back in May, senior counsel assisting the Royal Commission, Rowena Orr QC, said AMP may well have engaged in criminal activity.
And how have shareholders reacted to today's results?
Well, much of this bad news had been anticipated and baked in. So this morning, AMP shares are up almost 5% and Commonwealth Bank shares are up 2.3%, both of those in late morning trade.
Peter Ryan, the ABC Senior Business Correspondent, thank you. A child protection organisation is backing calls from abuse survivors for Peter Hollingworth to be stripped of his position as an Anglican bishop. The former Governor-General is under renewed scrutiny for his handling of abuse allegations when he was the Archbishop of Brisbane in the 1990s, as Samantha Donovan reports.
The fact Peter Hollingworth is still an Anglican bishop horrifies this abuse survivor.
It's a kick in the guts and a real slap in the face to everybody. I mean, I don't understand how the diocese could even allow him to be practising still, because for him, he would actually need a working with children check done.
The woman, who the ABC is calling Lyndall, was sexually abused by a housemaster, Kevin Guy, at the Anglican Toowoomba Prep School in the 1980s. Peter Hollingworth was the Archbishop of Brisbane from 1989 to 2001, when he was appointed Governor-General. In a statement to ABC News, Dr. Hollingworth's lawyer says the cleric had no knowledge of the offender at Toowoomba Prep and didn't meet him before he committed suicide. He also points out the allegations were examined by a 2003 inquiry, and it concluded Dr. Hollingworth had done nothing wrong in relation to that case. The Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission found Dr. Hollingworth had made a serious error of judgment when, as Archbishop, he allowed paedophile priest John Elliott to remain in the Anglican ministry despite being told he'd sexually abused children. Dr. Hollingworth's lawyer says the bishop has no official position with the church now, no power to make any decisions in the church, and his officiating is limited to ceremonies for old friends. Fiona Patten is the leader of the Reason Party in the Victorian Upper House. She's raised concerns in Parliament that Peter Hollingworth has cleared the working with children check requirements in Victoria.
Justice must be done, but it must also be seen to be done. Given the findings of the Royal Commission, given that this has been open information about the Bishop Hollingworth's involvement in a cover-up of child sexual abuse since, as you mentioned, 2003, Really, the church should ask him to resign or at the very least retire.
The Victorian Working with Children Check examines an applicant's criminal history, but as Dr Hollingworth has never been charged with any criminal offence, the World Today understands there's no reason he wouldn't pass a Victorian check. Hetty Johnston is the founder of child protection organisation Bravehearts. It led the calls for Peter Hollingworth to step down as Governor-General in the early 2000s. She also has concerns that Dr Hollingworth is allowed to work with children in Victoria.
Well, he certainly has it. He has it in Victoria because Victorian legislation allows him to, but there are other states like in Queensland where I doubt very much whether he would get a Working with Children check because it's not just based on criminal charges. It's also based on other evidence and other intelligence that police might gather. It's about whether you're of a good character to be working with children.
Hetty Johnston is adamant Peter Hollingworth should no longer have a role in the Anglican Church.
The church hasn't learnt that by now, then it never will. I mean, he's not a suitable person to be a bishop. His behaviour has demonstrated that. But this is the whole problem with the church, is this snubbing of all everything that's been learnt, everything that the community's expectations just get snubbed. And it's business as normal. You shouldn't be a bishop at all.
That's Hetty Johnston from Bravehearts, ending that report by Samantha Donovan. This is The World Today. Australia's Prime Minister made a gesture of conciliation to the Chinese government last night with a speech emphasising mutual respect and understanding to an audience which included a large delegation of Chinese diplomats. The relationship with Beijing has become strained in recent months by a series of issues, including China's activity in the South China Sea and the Australian government's foreign interference legislation. Malcolm Turnbull's speech comes days after Beijing signalled it was up to the Australian leaders to take steps to repair the relationship. So, will this speech do that? Professor James Lawrenson is the Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. James Lawrenson, you're among a number of China specialists calling for a reset in the Australia-China relationship. Did the Prime Minister's speech last night hit that reset button?
It put us on the right path. Let's not forget that we got to this state in the Australia-China relationship over an 18-month period where there's been some pretty loose rhetoric used by the federal government towards China. So you're not going to turn things around overnight. But that said, what the PM said yesterday, that's the way we've traditionally engaged with China, all the way from Whitlam to Abbott, and we diverged from that about 18 months ago. So it was more like Malcolm Turnbull was getting back to our normal approach to engaging with China, and I think that's a positive.
So you're saying it's a start. If you were advising the Prime Minister, would you have advised him to go further?
I would advise him to be consistent. And I think that's my guess. That's what Chinese diplomats will be looking for in the coming months. You know, as I said, we had some language from the beginning of 2017. Julie Bishop, for example, said that China couldn't achieve its economic potential unless it became a democracy like us. That's pretty gratuitous. And then, of course, Malcolm Turnbull, when he was introducing the foreign interference laws in December last year, he quoted Mao Zedong and specifically singled out media reports about Chinese influence. So I think the Chinese government will just be looking for a bit of consistency on the Australian government's part.
You've mentioned some of those tensions, and Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop hasn't visited China in 2 years. How bad has the relationship become?
Well, I think that says everything, doesn't it? When you haven't had a visit from the Foreign Minister in 2 years and the Prime Minister in the same amount of time, Australia and China, of course, are meant to engage, have annual leaders' dialogues with our foreign ministers and with our heads of state as well. That obviously hasn't happened this year. On top of that, you've had our big trade and investment roadshow, the Australia Week on China, that's been cancelled this year. So the relationship hasn't been in a good way, and we need to get it back on track.
We're always being told that the Chinese leaders respect strength. Isn't there equally an argument that Australia's Prime Minister should not bend over to appease the Chinese, especially given Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea?
Oh, look, absolutely. When it comes to the South China Sea, let's also be very clear that I think Julie Bishop's stance on that has been superb. Australia has a clear national interest in international law being upheld. So when China doesn't uphold international law, there is nothing inconsistent with a good relationship with China, with Australia calling that out. The problem is in the context of doing that, we've had all this other stuff, all this gratuitous rhetoric that hasn't helped. Let's be clear. I have never had a Chinese diplomat tell me they were angry about Australia's foreign interference laws. They they understand very well that Australia is a sovereign country. We can introduce any laws we like. What they didn't appreciate was being singled out.
This speech from the PM was clearly intended to send a message to the Chinese government. The ambassador was there in the audience. To what extent was it also a message, do you think, to the US President Donald Trump?
On trade, it was a clear message. In the speech, Turnbull made it very clear that on trade and our attitudes towards protectionism, tariffs, open economies, we are actually aligned with China on this, not aligned with the US. So yeah, I think there was some signalling towards the US as well. If the US continues to go down this path of protectionism, if it continues to withdraw from international forums such as the World Trade Organization, that's against Australia's interests. So our security alliance partner is going to have to understand we're not going to follow the US on those issues, and in fact, we'll be lining up with China.
Your institute gets funding from Chinese business leaders. To what extent does that compromise your ability to criticise China?
Yeah, glad you asked. We've got an annual report on our website, so all of our operating costs are actually funded by the University of Technology, Sydney. Only about 30% of our funding comes from a mix of 20 different companies. They're Australian and Chinese corporates. So this is a good example of where some of the commentary has actually run ahead of the facts. You'll find plenty of other think tanks in Australia that attract a whole lot more funding, foreign funding, than the Australian-China Relations Institute does.
James Lawrenson, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That's Professor James Lawrenson, the Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. The former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak has been charged with money laundering. The charges relate to the alleged looting of the state investment fund, 1MDB. The US Department of Justice says more than $6 billion was misappropriated from that fund by several high-level officials. Peter Lloyd joins me now with more details on this. Peter, what exactly has this former Prime Minister been charged with?
This time round, the charges are, there's three of them. It's for the looting, as you call it, of the state investment fund. The figure here is about 10.3 US million, about 13 Australian. Now, this carries penalties of 15 years in prison for each of those offences. So it's a lot of jail time, plus a fine, which, of course, he'd have the money to pay for, considering how much they found in his house recently. There's a staggering amount behind this. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the investigation. Since the government changed hands, there's been a thorough top head of government level effort to try and hunt down these billions, because the Malaysian economy is in the tank. They need the money back, and they believe that with the help of the United States, they can help find a lot of this money.
So this investigation doesn't just go Malaysia-wide, it's international?
It's international. Some of the money that was looted, allegedly, was used to finance things like the Hollywood film, of course, I can't remember the name of it now. about Wall Street. We all loved it, of course. And there's that. There's a luxurious yacht worth $250 million, which has just been reparked back in Malaysia. They finally got that back. There's money all over the place, but largely through bank accounts that were channeled through the Najib family estate. When he lost power back in May, you may remember there was a raid on his house and they found $270 million worth of goods inside the house. That's cash, jewellery, splendid handbags, which were owned by his wife, all sorts of money, which was unaccounted for, stashed literally in bags like a bagman.
So when is he likely to go to trial?
Well, the trial for the original set of charges, which he faced a few weeks back, was set for February next year. It's not clear from today's developments whether or not this will be compounded into that trial or a separate trial. Indeed, it might be that there is a series of trials. They might be held concurrently or one after the other. What he's trying to do, though, interestingly, is Najib's lawyers are trying to put a gag order on discussion of the charges. And they're attempting to make it a global. So they're trying to shut down discussion about this around the world. There will be witnesses from around the world involved in the case. There'll be witnesses from America, from Saudi Arabia, and possibly even Australia, where some of the money was parked.
And certainly the eyes of the world will be on this if they can be. Peter Lloyd, thanks very much. If you've ever called Centrelink, you won't be surprised that the average wait time, if you can get through it all, is more than a quarter of an hour. Well, today the federal government says it feels your frustration and is announcing plans to employ more call centre staff via an outsourced provider. But Labor MPs say the new staff should be employed directly in the public service, where they'll be properly trained and properly paid, as Tom Eagledon reports.
Good morning. Welcome to the Department of Human Services.
Taking a million calls a week, the Centrelink call centre is the biggest in the Southern Hemisphere.
If you are calling in relation to the childcare subsidy changes, please say childcare.
and also one of the most cumbersome. For many callers at busy times, this is all you'll get. Even when you can get through, you're in for a long wait before you can talk to a human. Here's Human Services Minister Michael Keenan.
We've got a large number of different lines, but on average it's about 15 and a half minutes. We think that's too long.
Labor says wait times have actually blown out over the last 12 months to more than 20 minutes for most callers and more than half an hour for some. Today the government's announcing an extra 1,500 people to man the phones at Centrelink on top of the 1,000 announced in April.
What will be good news for pensioners, for students and for others that rely on the Australian government for support.
Outsourcer Serco has been running a trial of the new operation with, says the minister, promising results.
The first 250 that are actually on board already, I mean, they've cut down busy signals by 20%. So you can appreciate when we're putting on the extra 1,500, the extra 1,000 that we've announced before, it's going to make a very significant improvement to those who are using the Australian Government service delivery.
But Labor's sceptical. Here's Shadow Human Services Minister Linda Burney.
The government has cut 2,500 jobs out of Centrelink over the last two budgets. And the notion that they're putting these jobs back is a net zero game, really.
We haven't been cutting the workforce in my department, but the thing is the workforce in my department changes over time in line with the fact that our requirements for what that workforce needs to do changes over time.
But Labor's also got a problem with that. The new staff won't be public servants, but contractors to private operators.
And the last thing that the government needs to be doing is privatising Centrelink by stealth, by outsourcing positions that they've already cut.
I think our customers are more interested in the service that we provide. I'm not sure that they're terribly concerned about where it is we get our workforce from. They want to know that they can pick up the phone's going to be answered as quickly as possible, and they're talking to someone who knows what they're doing. That is what is going to happen in the future.
But Labor says it's committed to bringing those jobs back into the public service.
I won't give you the number exactly now, but Labor is committed to additional full-time permanent public service positions in Centrelink.
That's Shadow Human Services Minister Linda Burney ending that report from Tom Eagledon. Now to that breakthrough from the CSIRO, which researchers say could turn Australia into a renewable energy superpower. Australian scientists say they've found a way to fuel hydrogen cars with hydrogen derived from ammonia. It's a breakthrough which addresses one of the difficulties with hydrogen cars, how to make the fuel readily available, as Rachel Mealy explains.
So it's called a membrane, but to the layperson it looks more like a bunch of metal rods. CSIRO scientist Michael Dolan has been working on the project for a decade.
We're certainly the first to demonstrate the production of very clean hydrogen from ammonia at the scales that we're talking about. So that is, you know, being able to make enough to refuel a vehicle. We're certainly clearly leading the world in that respect. And what's important about that is that it may help enable a whole new industry. So Australia already knows how to make and export ammonia. If we're using our technology, it actually allows that ammonia to be used in a whole new application, which is to refuel vehicles.
Hydrogen cars have been commercially available for a number of years now, but the challenge has always been how to make hydrogen readily available for refueling. Shipping hydrogen around the world is difficult because of its low density and because it's highly flammable. Dr. Dolan says the membrane is a game changer for hydrogen cars around the world.
So we're not necessarily tackling the making of hydrogen or the using of hydrogen. What we're tackling is a way of moving hydrogen across the planet from countries like Australia that have enormous energy reserves, including renewables, to countries like Japan that have almost none of their own energy reserves. So our technology helps enable that hydrogen value chain so that we can make hydrogen here and use it to fuel cars driving around Tokyo.
He says the breakthrough could be a boon for Australian industry and the environment.
Currently, most hydrogen is made from natural gas, so there's significant CO2 emissions involved. But with the decreasing cost of renewable energy technology, it's now becoming feasible to start making hydrogen renewably without any CO2 emissions at all. And given Australia's vast solar and wind energy resources, we're better placed than any country on the planet to be the renewable hydrogen superpower.
Scott Naga is from the car company Hyundai.
For a car manufacturer's point of view, we see this as a massive step for Australia. Working in and out of Korea quite regularly, working with the Korean government, Australian and the Australian governments, looking at how we can export Australia's energy throughout Asia. And Hyundai's got a massive contract to supply buses for the Korean government. Just in the last couple of days, within the Korean newspapers, the government's announced 16,000 cars will go on the road and over 300 hydrogen stations. They need to power those cars on gas from somewhere. Why couldn't it be renewable hydrogen from Australia?
Why not? That's Scott Naga from the Hyundai car company, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. And for those of you who are still wondering about that movie we referred to in the Malaysia corruption story, it is, of course, The Wolf of Wall Street. That's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.